Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for October 8th, 2017. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, got a big show planned tonight. Tim Snead, who now lives in Northern Virginia, born and raised in Western Tennessee. He authored a book in the past called Don't Stop at Green Lights, Why Walmart Voters Always Vote Republican. He's going to be our guest about 30 minutes into the podcast. He's in Texas right now doing hurricane relief efforts, so he's really got a lot of different places covered and a lot of different things, and we'll talk to Tim about all of that in just a little bit. But until then, we're going to discuss issues. One little follow-up, speaking of Virginia, you know, it's funny, our guest last week, Lowell Feld, the best reporter for Virginia, we asked him a question, why are the polls so tight? And I believe two polls came out this week on the Virginia governor's race, and both of them showed a double-digit lead for the Democrat, Ralph Northam. Did y'all notice that, Catherine?
No, I didn't, but that's great news.
Yeah, it was like 53-40 was one of them over Ed Gillespie. Tim, did you see those polls?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, so it's kind of like
those are better.
We ordered them up.
Yeah,
so it just changed our whole perspective there in a week's time. But let's talk about something new, something that really is in many ways not new. It's just who's saying it's new. Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State of the United States, a member of the Trump administration, somebody that should be on the team, in the tent, if you will. This week it was reported that in past months there was a situation where they were discussing, you know, ramping up troops, and Donald Trump compared that to staffing to open a hotel or a resort, and he left the room, and Rex Tillerson called him a moron. And then later reports, he even added effing moron to that. Very, very shocking for somebody that's supposed to be a member of the cabinet to tell other people in the administration so flatly what he thought of the president. Tim, what did you think of these comments?
Well, I mean, Stephanie Ruhle said for certain that her source told her that Tillerson used those exact words, with the F word included. Trump and Tillerson, of course, did the obligatory fake news thing. But apparently it's true after Trump. What did he do? He compared what we're doing in Afghanistan to like his renovation of a steakhouse or something that he owned, and that kind
something
of
to his
set Tillerson. Yeah, that kind of set Tillerson off. And you know we're watching that to see what happens to Rex Tillerson, because White House aides, I know, are wanting him out, and Trump is, of course, reported to be very angry with him, and I think he's thinking about canning him. I've never seen this happen before, anything remotely like this between a Secretary of State and a president publicly. This administration continues to break new ground. Is that the way to put this?
Most definitely. Catherine, I don't know that you get any takers on the bet that Rex Tillerson will be there by Christmas. But where you might get the action is, does he quit or is he fired? What's your odds on guess?
Yeah, I think I think he'll quit before he gets fired. But there's also that suicide pact that he made with Kelly and Mnuchin, I think.
Allegedly,
that that if any one of them gets fired, they'll all leave, or you know, they'll all leave at the same time. I just, you know, Bravo. He said the thing that we all think, but it would have meant a lot more if he also left. You know, like, I think, you know, it's easy to, you know, call someone a effing moron and then, you know, stick it out and stay in the job. It's another thing to, you know, be more outspoken and stand for your principles and leave and be more public about it. So, I mean, it's you know, it's fodder for the media and for, you know, it gives Donald Trump something to tweet about, I suppose. But in the final analysis, it doesn't really mean anything if he doesn't leave or be more outspoken about it, in my opinion.
Well, and I guess his, you know, even his private spin on it, baby, I'm staying for the American people. You know, if somebody like me that can, you know, withstand the Trump administration doesn't stay, who will he hire? Although we're beginning to wonder, you know, what the bottom of the barrel could look like if people like Scaramucci are not it. And one of the things you talk about, the denial, Tim, actually he never really denied it. He said, this is what gets me about Washington. They talk about this kind of thing. And I was sitting there going, what kind of job? I mean, somebody working at a fast food restaurant, if the guy working the fry oven or the fryer called the boss an effing moron, it'd be a story around the water cooler there. So, of course, it's a story. I don't know what goes on in the world of Exxon, but calling your boss an effing moron is a news story, particularly if you work in the White House and the administration. So I don't know what kind of strange denial that was, but that was his denial, which Jimmy Kimmel, among others, said, yeah, obviously he called him that. Did you think that?
Yeah, because he didn't deny saying it. He never denied saying it.
Yeah. Well, what was your take on that, Tim?
Well, still, though, they tried to put the thing off on the media, you know, Trump especially. But, you know, yeah, he said it. Of course he said it. Why would something like that come out from nowhere if he
exactly.
didn't say it? And Stephanie Ruhle has an excellent reputation. And when she says she's quoting a source that assured her of that, I'm sure she's talking about somebody in the room that heard him say it. So, yeah, he said it. There's no doubt. That he said, what I can't believe, though, is that we are seeing things like this happen. Could you have imagined anyone calling Lyndon Johnson an effing moron when he was president, one of his members of his cabinet? Well, could you imagine that happening with any other president, like, ever? I mean, this...
Yeah, well, there's
things that are...
Yeah, go ahead,
Kathy. Shouldn't be going on.
Okay. Well, I'll go ahead and jump in. Basically, there's two reasons. One, most of our presidents, hopefully many, many more than not, have not been effing morons. I mean, that's one reason they haven't been called that. But two, and this what it speaks to a bigger issue now that we've gotten ourselves into this mess... even though the three of us weren't willing accomplices in that, is that, you know, one of Donald Trump's supposed strong suits was the strong leadership. He'll stand up. Well, apparently his own people don't respect him. His own people talk about him like we talk about him, like late-night talk show host and other comedians talk about him. They see the same thing we do, and they're not, you know, they're willing to say it. So there's no fear there. So that kind of, you know, is a big chink in the armor of one of his supposed better qualities, because they're pretty rare in a lot of people's estimation. Catherine?
Yeah, I think, I think like what you said, I don't think any of our previous presidents is, you know, as frustrated and unhappy as we may have been during certain administrations, I don't think we thought they were morons. We might not have agreed with their principles. We might not have thought they were, presenting policies that were important to us, but we didn't think they were morons. So now everybody sees that he's a moron, and it's hard to resist saying it. And, he is. He doesn't know what he's doing. How can you compare, ramping up in, a war to opening, to remodeling a steakhouse? Yeah, there's nothing, there's no similarities in that. So it's hard to resist, and I don't know. He's a moron.
Since day one, Trump has acted just like this, and what he's done over a period of time, he has cheapened that office. Before, there was always dignity. We admired the office, even if we didn't have great admiration for the person in it, because they treated the office with dignity themselves. There was a certain decorum. Even Nixon would have never, or any of our worst presidents, would have never done and said these things in public. I don't know what it's going to take now to restore the dignity of the office. This is how much damage this man has done to it with this in-your-face, bombastic, and forgive me for saying this, folks, because I know there's a lot of wrestling fans in the South, but live Atlanta wrestling nonsense. It's just shameful to see it happen, and I wish somehow this man would go away.
Yeah, a final thought on this before we kind of slowly change gears, although it's just some more of the same conversation in a lot of ways, is in the past 14 days, Jemele Hill called him a white supremacist on a private Twitter account. Michael Che called him a cheap cracker in the context of Saturday Night Live News. People called, all these people called for their firings. Conservatives, and Rex Tillerson calls him an effing moron, and he still has got his job. Seems kind of crazy to me. It seems like it's very much an us versus them construct he's created too. But what kind of came out of this is somebody asked Bob Corker, senator from Tennessee, what do you think of this whole thing with Rex Tillerson? And he said, people like Rex, and then he referenced the suicide pact Catherine mentioned between General Mattis, Steve Mnuchin, and Rex Tillerson. He said, men like them are what's keeping us from chaos, which would imply that the, occupant of the Oval Office is the center of the chaos. And so Donald Trump then this morning took an attack on Bob Corker, saying that he would have run somebody else against him because he's not running for re-election, and he would have won. His Donald Trump's endorsed candidate would have defeated him. He was scared. He, just not a great senator. All these negative things in his tweets, because he tweeted about three in a row this morning on him. And then Bob Corker tweeted back that the White House has become an adult daycare center, and somebody missed their shift. Like Donald Trump needs babysitting. This is a senator from Tennessee saying this about the president in a completely open forum and back and forth. And this is his own party also. This isn't a Democrat saying this. This is a Republican. Catherine, I'll give you the first crack at this one. What about this Twitter war with somebody that he supposedly wanted for his administration, Secretary of State?
Yeah, it's just like Tim said, it's just shameful. It's entertaining. Ha ha ha. It's like a, adult daycare. Ha ha. That's funny. But he's the president and he's a senator. So can someone please resist this kind of, as to use Tim's words again, this bombastic behavior? I thought it was funny, but at the same time, I'm kind of disappointed that Corker, you know, responded, that he fell for the, you know, the bait, so to speak. Like, it would be best if everybody just ignored that, all that Twitter from the president. It just gives him more, more likes and more retweets and more.
He is the bully pulpit. He's almost impossible to ignore. The office is considered the leader of the free world, although people now claim that may be Angela Merkel. But, I mean, it's hard to ignore that office.
I know it's hard, but it's also, I don't know. I'm probably wrong. It just kind of disgusts me, the whole thing.
Well, you want the dialogue to be raised at a level that you probably don't think Donald Trump's capable of. Therefore, that seems like, you know, the only recourse we have is to ignore it. Tim, your thoughts on what Bob Corker said, and Donald Trump said about Bob Corker?
Well, nothing surprises me that Donald Trump does. He wants to do this. I think he believes this is helping him politically. That is keeping his base engaged and excited. And I believe Bob, that Bob Corker kind of might have played into his hands a little bit with this sort of thing, because Trump goes casting about for these people. Anybody will do, the NFL, a U.S. senator, as we'll talk about in a few minutes, I'm sure, late night talk show host. Anybody and everybody that he can engage with in this way, he's going to do it. And all because Corker said one thing to start with, that you know, Trump's a negative voice for the Republican agenda. Well, duh. You know what I'd like to ask Bob Corker, though? I'd like to ask him, well, Bob, on Election Day last year, who'd you vote for? That's what I'd like to ask him. And then he says, well, you know, I voted for the Republican nominee, which is the way he had put it. I'd say, well, that was Donald Trump, and you knew how he was. What did you expect? I mean, you should be getting exactly what you've expected out of this guy. And this guy, as we now all know, it's not going to change. It's going to be this way from now on, and next week it'll be somebody else. If there isn't anyone who steps forward, Trump will go find them. So,
yep.
You know.
Yeah, he'll make his enemy, he will. And that's the one thing, is the Republicans, they seem to flourish the most when a new Democrat takes the Oval Office and gives them an enemy. The ones that truly, you know, thought that Donald Trump was unfit for office, even if they didn't want to see Hillary Clinton as president, they would have had a foil to create, you know, do what they like to do, and they wouldn't have to suffer through Donald Trump, because, you know, the map is doing them some favors on the Senate level. Obviously, we've heard about gerrymandering doing them favors in the House level, but if not, I mean, their party could be completely swept out of both houses in a way that they can recover for cycles to come. Well, let's talk about one of those races, and one that could be quite a shock. We have talked about this Alabama Senate race, but we've yet to talk about it since the runoff, and we know the two candidates. Doug Jones is going to be the Democratic nominee, and Roy Moore is going to be the Republican nominee, and the race has certainly tightened since that's happened. Polls are anywhere from about a 6 to 4 point lead. Although some of those are like 50-46 with Roy Moore leading. So not giving Doug Jones a lot of wiggle room to, he can't lose many more voters because there's very few undecideds. Although one, I think, had Roy Moore under 50, but then Doug Jones was lower. So he's definitely going to have to either move some voters over, or he's going to have to hope that there's a depressed Republican turnout and a very heightened Democratic turnout in a tough state like Alabama. Catherine, what's your take on the lay of the land in Alabama?
It's going to be a tight race. I think it's, you know, like always, turnout is going to be really important. And I think everybody's banking on sort of a Republican, you know, the middle of the road Republicans not being able to hold their nose and vote for Roy Moore, but not coming out to vote for Doug Jones. And then, you know, crossing our fingers and, you know, working the GOTV to get as many Democrats out to vote for Doug Jones. But I think it's going to be really tight, and I can't honestly predict that Doug Jones will win. All we can do is hope that everything goes the Democrats' way and he wins, because having Roy Moore as a senator is a really scary, scary thought to me.
Yeah, Tim, one thing that I think does set this race apart from a lot of these other special elections is, even though us in Georgia, you know, Karen Handel's not our favorite person being Georgia Democrats, but she's not a national, you know, boogeyman like Roy Moore. If you take the Kansas seat, the Republican guy that actually won the race, I can't remember his name, but with South Carolina. Now, Montana changed a little bit right before Election Day because of the way Greg Gianforte assaulted the reporter, but that was actually after a lot of the votes had been cast. It was all about, you know, let's elect a Democrat to not elect a Republican and show the country that the direction we're headed is wrong. So you have that same dynamic in Alabama. Wouldn't help you as much as it would in other states. But in this case, you have kind of a David Duke, Edwin Edwards type race where you can tell people that maybe typically vote Republican, you know, don't embarrass our state with this guy. It's not even about Doug Jones. It's about this guy. How do you think that added dynamic is going to affect the race?
Well, there's even a further dynamic in that the fact that, you know, Moore defeated Luther Strange and our glorious president suffered a massive embarrassment as a result, which means he's now forced to wheel and support Moore. And I'm sure he hopes Moore will at least win so he can still save the day by claiming credit or whatever. But look, no Democrat has been elected to the Senate since 1990, and that was Shelby before he switched parties. No Democrat has won, you know, the presidential race in Alabama since Jimmy Carter in 1976. There hasn't been a barrage of negative ads yet introduced against Jones. And I'm going to say that Moore will win.
Okay.
5 to 10 points. I wish it would be better than that, but I'm going to have to see it, man. This is Alabama. The deepest red state in this part of the country, and Roy Moore's pretty deep in red, and those evangelicals will get poor out there to vote for him. I guarantee it. Everybody I work with that lives in the state of Alabama is enthusiastically going to vote for him, and unfortunately, there's more of them than the votes we're looking for. So I don't think there's, you know, I'm hopeful, but not that hopeful.
Okay, well, let's bring up another wrinkle. John Anzalone, pollster, probably the preeminent pollster from Alabama. You could probably expand that out and say in the South or in the one of the top of the nation, that kind of thing. But definitely knows Alabama since he's based out of Montgomery. He's, you know, postulated that Doug Jones has an authentic type bio. I mean, he's the kind of guy that has an opinion about who wins the Iron Bowl, probably been to the top of the river, could wax poetic about the Vulcan. I mean, he's a real Alabamian. He's not some kind of artificial guy that came in from out of state. He's much like the son or the grandson of the folks that actually used to vote Democratic back in the past, and, you know, had been appointed as one of the attorneys, federal attorneys. So he's had a track record, better known than, you know, a lot of the candidates have run Alabama lately. And so he thinks that's going to help a lot. Catherine, how much do you think his better fit bio for Alabama will help Doug Jones.
Well, I agree with Tim. I mean, it's been a long time since we elected a Republican or a Democrat in Alabama. It could happen, but I mean, I think his heritage and his history have, you know, not many voters look that deep into a candidate. They see the D or the R, or they know something about them. They know them, or they know their, you know, recent activities. So, I mean, I think those are important things, but I just don't know that they'll have much of an impact.
Yeah. Tim, I want to take you back to a race that we discussed a long time, about 2 or 3 years ago, and that would be the Louisiana governor's race. David Vitter was a flawed candidate, but everybody said Louisiana, particularly the post-Katrina Louisiana, is just a Republican place. It doesn't matter, you know, how bad his bio, John Bel Edwards is not going to win. Well, we now call him Governor John Bel Edwards. Why is this race not going to be like that Louisiana gubernatorial race, which was such a shocker in the South?
Because Louisiana on its worst day is not as conservative as Alabama is, because Roy Moore is more of a fit for Alabama, I'm sorry to say, than David Vitter was for Louisiana. Because with all of Roy Moore's craziness, he doesn't have a sex scandal or something of the sensational nature that David Vitter did. So it's a lot of difference, I think. Also, I think Edward's probably a superior candidate to, even though we've got a good candidate, this is not John Bel Edwards we're talking about here. Edwards was an old seasoned politico that knew exactly what he was doing. And also the Republican Party was pretty fractured over there. You know, there were some Republican losers in the primaries that turned around and endorsed Edwards. I think it's all different. I don't think it's fair to compare them.
And then of course the other would be the opposite of it in so many ways. The Massachusetts special election for Senate, where Scott Brown defeated Martha Coakley to fill Ted Kennedy's seat. And, of course, that's like just the complete inverse of the thing. But people point that one out. Although I will say this, for whatever reason, Republicans in states like Massachusetts and Maryland do a whole lot better job electing their people than Democrats do in states like Alabama and others electing Democrats. And so that's one problem there. Tim, you say a question?
No, I think I've said quite enough on that subject.
Yeah. Well, one last thing, because I know our guest is going to come on in a minute, so I want to be ready and be flexible. Don't want to get another topic started. And we hadn't even really talked about Roy Moore. But I want to tell you, we've been talking about Roy Moore for a long time on this show. I think Roy Moore actually predates this show on some of his news making. And I remember early on with Roy Moore and the Ten Commandments and whatnot, you'd see him, and he looked harsh, and he looked old school, but he'd wear a robe, and he'd wear a tie, and he sort of looked like he was sane. Not saying I, you know, agreed with how, you know, resolute in his opinion he was to, you know, disregarding every other, you know, judicial precedence that came down, but he looks sane. You see him waving around that little gun. I mean, I don't know that much about guns, but that didn't even like a little gun almost. It was so small. And he wears this little cowboy hat and his leather vest, and he rides around on his horse now. I've been to Alabama. They have roads. They actually build automobiles now that they, you know, they don't have to get around on horse and buggy anymore. To me, Roy Moore looks a little off his rocker. Since our guest is about to come on, Catherine, give me the one-word answer. Does he look less sane than you? Yes or no?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, Tim, less sane or more sane or the same?
I'd say it's the same as he's always been.
Oh.
about the same as he's always been. Okay, maybe it's just his dress. I don't know. Well, let's go ahead and switch gears, and we've got our guest coming on here, Mr. Tim Snead, the author of Don't Stop at Red Lights. Don't Stop at Green Lights. Just Stop at Red Lights. Don't Stop at Green Lights. Why Walmart shoppers always vote Republican. He's done advance work for a lot of Democratic candidates and currently helping out folks in Texas with relief efforts. Welcome to the Kudzu Vine, Mr. Snead.
Thanks for having me, David. And Catherine, is there somebody else there?
And yeah, there's another Tim Shiflett. So I'll try to direct traffic on the Tims. We've had the two Davids before, but never the two Tims. We've had a Tim in the past. Tim, first off, you've written a book. Tell us, because I think it kind of fits into your bio, tell us about your book.
Say it again. I'm in South Texas.
Tell us about your book, Don't Stop at Green Lights. Give us a little background on it.
The reason I wrote the book is I'd worked for the John Kerry campaign in 2004. And after we lost the election, I was like, we were out there fighting for all these poor people, but they voted for, Bush. And I was like, you're the ones on food stamps. You're the one in public housing. You're the one that's driving the beat up truck. You're the one that doesn't have a union job or doesn't have a living wage, and that. For disproportionately the education. And then I was like, why? And I couldn't figure it out because I traveled the whole country for John Kerry as an advanced person. And it was like, why are these people voting against us? Why are they so hung up into voting for Republicans? People that didn't go out and help them get disability, didn't go out and get them EBD, food stamps, didn't get them disability. I mean, why? So that's why I wrote the book. And so basically, after I started writing, I couldn't stop. And I've got about 30 chapters in there, but I just tell story after story about individuals that vote against their self-interest. Now, to start this talk off, if I know the answers why poor people, working class people vote against their self-interest, I'd be more than just helping with disaster relief. I'd in New York City living a big life or something like that. But anyway, that's why I wrote the book. I mean, it's just I was the anger was there. And also, after 9/11 happened, I just finished law school, and I did the they were taking away the Patriot Act, and they were giving away so many rights after 9/11 happened. I was like, oh my gosh, somebody's got to say something to these people. And John Kerry stood up. He said, hey, this ain't right. And nobody else. You got to realize Bush had ratings of what, 80, 90? John Kerry said, we'll make change that, but we tried. We gave a good fight, but it didn't happen. So that's how the book got started. That's how the anger, yeah. Not the anger, but the, go ahead.
Yeah, well, as the term Walmart voters has been used some other places too to kind of represent, voters in maybe more rural or suburban areas. Let me. There's been a lot of talk about what's called siloing. People living in different worlds from each other. People living in the city. People living outside the city. People shopping at these kind of places. People watching these kind of TV shows. People watching these sports, not these sports. These movies and all these divisions. Do you think there's something to do with if one side or the other, not adopting every portion of the others the way they live, because there's just some things that just aren't going to be with one side or the other's values, but do you think there's some things that could be adopted to help better understand the other side?
Well, I think that's an awful complicated issue you just asked. We spent the next 5 years studying that, But I think in most of America, outside your large cities here, the guy that works at the bank, or the banker, as we'd always say, he's looking at the guy that works for the cable company or the guy that works for the utility company. Each one of them want to belong to something or another. So I'm better than you if I'm not drawing food stamps. Even though 10 years ago before I got my job, I was on food stamps. So my point being is I think in any city outside cities where people don't know each other, it's comparing to each other. I'm doing better than you. Since I'm not on food stamps, I'm voting Republican because I know your poor butt is voting Democrat. I think it's not that complicated, you know. I mean, is that not a sophisticated enough answer? I mean, it ain't real simple. I mean, we saw that with Bernie Sanders, you know. He fired people up, you know. He said, hey, you know, grassroots, y'all can do this. You know, I don't need your, you know, Hamptons, you know, $30,000 donation, you know. So you just get some way that you've got to reach and touch these people, you know. And I don't know how to do it without doing this. The only thing I know to do is say, sir or ma'am, you were on food stamps, public assistance. You went to college on a education program provided by Democrats. How in the world can you vote Republican now? Those people didn't cheer for you, you know. But then you go back to the poor people, the people that are on food stamps, you know. I've never seen a poor person testify before the anything in Washington about, sir, I need food stamps. It's the major corporations. It's Quaker Oats. It says, hey guys, we can sell a lot of oats if we'll let poor people get food stamps, you know. And you say, what does food stamps have to do with Republicans? But we keep creating this class of poor people, you know. I mean, I don't have the answers. I wish, you know, maybe I should have called in, but I just get so fired up at poor people voting against their self-interest, you know. I mean.
Well, we discuss complex questions. As you were calling in, I asked Catherine and Tim a yes or no question. We rarely do that. We deal in paragraphs and complete thoughts, so that's when we ask you those. Well, let me pass it over to Tim Shiflett so he can ask you more questions. Tim?
All right. Tim, go ahead.
Good evening, sir. Thank you for being with us tonight. I know you're very busy down there in Texas. Now, the latest polling, the latest polling shows that Donald Trump still has an 85% approval rating with Republican voters, most of which, of course, is his base. How do we shake those voters loose from Donald Trump?
Well, as Richard Nixon was being impeached, he still had, I think they say, 25% of his base. You know, that's a long way from 75%. But I think the reality is, you know, is that people are going to say, dang, yeah, I'm mad at that guy down there. You know, I'm mad at that Hispanic guy for getting that opportunity. I'm mad at that black guy for getting this opportunity. I'm talking about white people now that are saying this, you know, because I got to think disproportionately that is a large percent of his base, white, Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to think what happens is people, once you get mad at somebody down home, I know they don't like to talk about it, but once I'm mad at you, I need to hit somebody. Well, as we get more educated, we don't hit them. But that's what happened. These people, these white people, as we will say, said, Donald, he's killing them. He's going to build that wall, you know. He's not going to help Puerto Rico where those, he thinks they're Mexicans down there, but they're not, you know. So I think for his population, that 75% you're talking about, I think eventually they're going to say, hey, that mother down there that's needing water in Puerto Rico, Donald's got this wrong. He can't throw a roll of paper towels in the audience and think he's at an NBA basketball game, you know. I mean, so I just think that's what's going to happen. I think we're going to have a shift because what happened was, I wish I was smarter because I could say something better, but this all started with when 9/11 happened. People were angry, and they wanted to hit somebody. George Bush got elected again. People were – after we went to Iraq and started bombing people around the world, after Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice messed us up on the information, but we started bombing somebody because, remember, we was mad at somebody. We had to hit somebody. Somebody needed hit. So we hit – and then the American people, since 9/11 – we've been hitting everybody, you know. these white people, you know. But then their heart lightens up, because I want to think most Americans are great people, you know, whether they vote Republican or Democrat. You know, I want to think their heart's good. They get upset at times, just like we do, you know, like anybody does. And I think what happened is they got so upset. That's why Barack Obama got elected. They said, gosh, let's give this black guy a chance. You know, we've been pushing this hate. We've killed 5,500. Every time kids we killed, I think kids in Afghanistan said, let's elect Barack Obama. We gave Barack Obama a chance for 8 years, and then people said, oh, shit, shucks, we can't have that anymore. Let's take this country back. And I think if we take this country back, or you can paraphrase, let's make America great again. I thought it was pretty good under Barack Obama. But people were angry. His base, that 25 changes, you know. I mean, anyway, that's my little thing.
One thing I did want to ask you while I had you on here, because you've worked in several presidential campaigns over the years.
Right.
Of all the campaigns you've worked in, which one was your favorite and why?
Oh, I think the most favorite one was the one. Well, there's never a simple answer, you know. My first one, you know, John Kerry was my first one. I still love the man and always will, I guess. But the Barack Obama campaign and Joe Biden campaign, it started out Barack Obama, and then they brought on Joe Biden. That was unbelievable. It was they run a tight ship. And from reading my book and from knowing my personality, I shoot from the hip sometimes, you know. But Ms. Valerie Jarrett and them, they run a tight ship. And me not being a structured person, Barack Obama and them kept it tight. And we played by the rules. I think the guy went 8 years with having the first boo-boo, as we'd say, in his administration, you know. We didn't have six people quit the first 2 or 3 months, you know. We didn't have people getting fired and I don't even know if there's an investigation with Obama. So I felt like I had moved up to the varsity, you know, game. So anytime people become that, they think, oh, damn, I'm a part of the A game. So and I was blessed to be there. It was 8 years of headaches and heartaches, and I always felt like I was doing something good on every trip, you know. I mean,
all right.
So
well, with that,
Obama. Yep,
Obama.
That's it.
Okay.
Obama.
Well,
yep.
With that, I am going to send it over to Catherine.
Hello, Miss Catherine.
Catherine, you with us?
Catherine.
I'm sorry. I had to unmute. I'm sorry. I'm here. Sorry. Thanks
Catherine,
for being on.
You know my billable hours now. You got to get it tight here now. I mean,
I'm sorry. I try to mute so I don't make a lot of noise.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you about your hurricane relief work that you're doing, just briefly. Like, what's going on, and how are things looking in Texas, and how did you end up helping out down there?
Well, doing advance work. I don't know what our public knows about doing advance work, but you become we become fixers, whether it's a good fixer or a bad fixer, we become fixers, and you learn all the other people in the industry. So, you know, people realize Tim Snead has certain strengths. Tim Snead has a lot of weaknesses, you know. Don't let Tim write a policy paper. You know what I'm saying? Tim doesn't need to know but if you need to make it happen, if you need the van set up, or if you need the trees removed, or if you need the tobacco sold or a quota sold, Tim Snead can organize it. He'll show up on time. And I'll tell you this, one thing I've learned in the last 8 years is showing up. I've heard that a million times. It's showing up 90% of it, you know. It's just what happens working and doing advance, you got to realize I just had 8 years of unbelievable living. Life, you know, experiences. But when it was over with, the 20th of January, I'm unemployed, you know. So thank God I've got my wholesale textbook business and I still can keep going. I'm not going to get on that welfare today anyway, but thank God it's there. If I need it, I would get on it, you know. So what happened is people know what I do and can do, and I have a little bit of logistics, you know, area of goodness or whatever, and somebody saw it they needed people in Texas. A friend of mine texted me and said, hey, you know, can you go to Texas tomorrow? And I said, yep, bags are packed. And it took about a week to get here because I didn't know, you know, you got to get contracts and all that. But so I'm down here. I didn't know what this was. They asked me if I could be a PM. And I said, a prime minister? What's PM? But I'm a project manager. Couldn't spell it 2 weeks ago, but I got three cities down here, three cities, 4, 6, 8 crews. We were cleaning up the vegetation and the construction and debris, and we do it methodically. Nobody can say, hey, can you come and clean mine up? We'll get to you when we can, you know. And that's how I got the job. But it's going well down here, I think. I can't speak for my company, but I think we're, you know, I'm just a PM, as you found out. So, but I think we're on target, you know, to make it happen. I mean, life is good. But I tell you, the sad thing about it is these people are getting back on their feet here. But I haven't watched much TV because we're putting in 18-hour days, and I'm not complaining. I'm glad to be here. But we've got to do something about Puerto Rico. That man has got to realize it's more than just a small island that has a lot of water around it. I mean, water and island kind of go together. I don't think he needed to say the second part. But anyway, so that's what I'm doing. We got all our crews are quitting right now, and I'm headed to the shop. I mean, to the field. The debris field right
now. Well, good. Important work, and thank you.
I'm blessed to be here. And this is the thing, just this contract here in Texas, this wasn't, you know, another Democratic thing. You know what I'm saying? This is, let's help our people get back. Our people are better when they're back working and their streets are clean. I mean, we can't give up on the Democrats, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I don't know who gave us FEMA. I don't know which administration, but it's an unbelievable operation, you know. So, and they are, let me say this, they are wonderful to pay a dollar. That we have so many checks and balances. As crisis as this down, we're watching Americans' dollar, so they can feel good about that, you know. So I'm excited.
Well, that's great.
When I saw that,
I'm going to go ahead and pass it back to David.
All right, David.
Yeah, Tim, thank you for coming on the Kudzu Vine tonight. One last thing before you go, just tell us a little bit about, like, where people can get your book, or if people wanted you to do advance work, how they can get a hold of you on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, whatever the case may be.
Well, I'm not my social media is – I'm not really all that fancy. You know, I still use the dial-up phone a lot, you know. But now they can go on, I think it's on Amazon, but if they go to my LinkedIn page, they can contact me there. We can get them a copy. We just happen to have, you know, I hate to say this, but we might have had too many books, but we got a few thousand we could get out if anybody wanted them, you know what I'm saying? But so it's definitely available if people want to go to Amazon, or they can go to my webpage or LinkedIn, whatever. We can get it to them, you know. It's still relevant today.
All right.
That's amazing. That's amazing. All right. Thank you, Bubba. I appreciate this.
Yeah. Well, no,
you know.
Thank you.
If I had to answer these questions, I'd be, like I said, I'd be in a fancy suite in New York, you know. I don't drink, but I'd have a big old Diet Coca-Cola with me or something, you know. But anyway.
Well, you're doing good work down there in Texas, and so we're all appreciating you being down there.
I'm blessed. Thank y'all for having me. I'm blessed to be able to do what I'm doing, and hopefully somebody gets something good out of it, you know. So I appreciate you.
All right.
Call.
Thanks again, Tim. That was Tim Snead, author, political advance man, and all-around helper of everyone down there in Corpus Christi, Texas, but he lives in Northern Virginia most of the other time, born and raised in Tennessee. Well, that was good to have. I think we've got time for just one more topic, and it's something we've talked about a little bit, but as it gets closer to November, it begins to be more and more pressing, and that would be the Atlanta mayoral race. when we talked about it before, I believe Mary Norwood was in the lead, and then was Cesar Mitchell, was he second, or was a different gentleman? There's so many candidates, I honestly can't keep all of them straight. Or was a different gentleman second? But now in the latest poll, Keisha Lance Bottoms has moved into second place, which in the runoff system, first and second is everything. I mean, being second usually doesn't sound good, but second means you get to run again and get another shot in a head-to-head battle. So we've kind of had a change in the second position, but then that's not to say this whole thing's done, because there's still many, many candidates in this race, and a lot of them have very high profiles. Catherine, you're down there in Atlanta. What's your take on some things?
Well, I was surprised by that poll, putting Keisha up in the second spot. Honestly, I didn't expect it. There were some questions about the poll. I believe that it was predominantly dial-up phones, or you know landlines, and some questions about that. So there were some questions about that. So whatever that means. But I think ultimately it's going to be like probably four-way maybe between Mary, Keisha, Caesar, and maybe either Peter Ammon or Kathy Woolard. Kathy Woolard's getting a lot more traction all of a sudden. I was just talking with some people yesterday, and everybody was like, yeah, all of a sudden she's in my Facebook feed a lot more. I'm seeing a lot more ads, and so – so maybe she's putting in a final push to get some more traction. But like you said, it's really going to be about the runoff. And I think a lot of people are, I think it's pretty clear that Mary Norwood's going to be in the runoff. Unless this, Republican, this message around her being a Republican really takes hold. But I still think that she's got a lot of support in the more conservative parts of Atlanta. So I think she'll I do believe she'll be in the runoff. So it's really going to be a question of who's with her in the runoff. And it looks like it could be any of the people, but there's a bunch of them that are way down in the, 1-3% in that most recent poll. And even with the questions about the poll, that's not going to change that significantly. So I think we're looking at Caesar, Kathy, Keisha, maybe Ammon in the second spot.
Well, Tim, I'll get your initial thoughts on the poll. Then I want to come back to Catherine about something she alluded to. Tim, what's some of your thoughts about the state of the race overall?
Let's see. This was an 11 Alive poll, I think, was the latest one. And Mary Norwood continues to, set in a solid first place with 28%. And you mentioned Bottoms moving into second at 15. Now, that's her best showing to date in any poll. So if she's peaking, she's doing it at just the right time. Then Cesar Mitchell, who had been running second, is running third at 10. Then you got four candidates, Ammon, Fort, Kwanzaa Hall, and Kathy Woolard, all at 7%. And something to watch, there's still like 14% of the undecided. When you have this many candidates bunched together, 2 or 3% of that would be gold for these people. Norwood gets 40% of the white vote. She's running second, which is surprising to me, among black voters, but I still think she might be facing a ceiling like she was against Mayor Reed. But she will be in the runoff, according to this poll, and probably either Keisha Lance Bottoms or Cesar Mitchell, or I'm going to say the fourth one that might, the other one that might slip in would be Kwanzaa Hall, but that's just a guess.
Yeah, of course, I'm going to ask Catherine a serious question, but don't you just sort of wish Keisha Lance Bottoms could take the lead in the poll, and that way they could put the headline bottoms is top. You know, that would be quite a headline.
Well, she's
but
got
seriously,
a
seriously, Catherine.
Go ahead.
You know, this attack, if people don't know, the Democratic Party of Georgia was actually involved in some of the funding for this, is Mary Norwood's Republican ties. And there's pictures with her and Karen Handel and the chair of the Fulton County Republican Party. I mean, if she's not a Republican, she needs a better advisor telling her, don't pose for these pictures, you know. And there's other things linking her to the Republican Party. Now, this same kind of thing happened about 8 years ago when she was running the runoff against Kasim Reed. I don't think it was this hard. It didn't have the photos with it, which you'd think she would have learned from it. It was in the runoff, not in the primary. So my question to you, Catherine, is how effective or how much do you think this will hurt her? And then who is the beneficiary of the support, if some people may say, well, she can't win the runoff, so I better switch to somebody else?
That's a really good question. I haven't really thought that much about who's the beneficiary of this Republican accusations of her being a Republican. I mean, it's clear that she is. She served as the Republican representative on the Fulton County Board of Elections, which has two Republicans, two Democrats, and a chair, and who is supposedly nonpartisan. So, I mean, there's really no question about it in my mind. Which, you know, that's fine. She's a Republican. She's perfectly entitled to be a Republican. I think the beneficiaries are probably the top three non-Mary candidates, right? I mean, I don't know that you can really say one of them is going to benefit from this. Probably Keisha, Caesar, and Kwanzaa, and maybe Kathy Woolard benefit. I don't know that Peter Ammon benefits from it, because I don't think anybody really has a good handle on what his political ties are, because he's shown up at Republican and Democratic events, so he's probably a little bit of a cipher as far as his actual political identity. So I think all the Democrats on the ticket who don't identify necessarily as Democrats, because it's a nonpartisan race, but I think almost everyone else besides Mary would probably be considered in the Democratic rankings, except maybe Ammon. So that's not really much of an answer,
okay. But
that's what I think.
It's a lot of candidates, so it's really, really complicated. Tim, give us your minute and a half take on this attack on Mary Norwood and what the implications will be.
Well, I totally agree with Catherine. It's very obvious she is a Republican. But I still go back to what I said before the show came on. Attack or not, I still think she has a problem. And that problem is, for whatever reason, she has a ceiling of support. And that ceiling is below 50% plus one. And with that ceiling, if it holds, she is going to lose the runoff as all the opponents' candidates coalesce around the remaining opponent that she will have. She had that problem 8 years ago. I think she's going to have that problem this time. I think she's going to run very well among white voters. I do not think she is going to run very well among other voters. I think the white voters that are voting for her are the conservative voters who recognize her for the Republican that she is, which would be 35-40% of the vote. And she'll, you know, get some more votes with it. But I don't think she's going to get enough to win.
Yes. Well, that's been about the show tonight. Thanks again to Tim Snead. And, of course, we got the gift in the Oval Office that always gives us content. That's the only bright side to his presidency and other races going on. We'll be back next week with the Kudzu Vine. Good night, everybody.
Good night, y'all.
Good night, guys.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
With a strong and